This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Evolution of the World and of Humanity. This is Lecture 4. Between the waking and sleeping life of man, which I have sketched in outline in the last lectures, lies the life of dreams. This dream life, which is of so little significance for the immediate reality of daily life, is shown by the deeper cognition to be of the greatest conceivable significance, not only to man, but to the world. Not only do I say this because its significance is so fully appreciated by the spiritual science which is in question here, and leads from observation of dreams to many another subject, but also because dream life represents, so to speak, a small opening, through which certain worlds other than this, which we experience in our waking life, shine through into this higher world. Thus, through the enigmatical character of dream formations, a man's attention may not only be drawn to the fact that in the lower strata of that world, which is accessible to him, and in higher strata too, there are other worlds, but he also becomes aware of the possible character of those worlds. On the other hand, it is extremely difficult to penetrate into this very enigmatical dream life from the standpoint of the higher consciousness. For the dream is a power capable of leading man into the greatest possible illusion. With regard to dreams, one may easily be inclined wrongly to connect what is illusionary in life with its reality. Confining ourselves to what I have already said about the life of sleep, and also about repeated earth lives, let us go further into this. An example frequently repeated in some form or other is that in a dream a person believes he has made something which in his waking life he never could have made, and which in fact would be quite beyond the realms of possibility in his present earth life. Then he proceeds to dream that he cannot find it, while rushing about like one demented, looking for it. Let us consider this example concretely. The form of this dream varies according to the character of the dreamer. A humble tailor in a small provincial town may dream that he has made the robes of state for a cabinet minister and is very proud of it. But the dream changes its character, and he dreams that he cannot find the robes which he was to deliver at the minister's residence. He looks everywhere in vain. Here is a dream absolutely following a course which the dreamer may well have desired, though he certainly could not have carried it out in life. This little tailor in a provincial town could not have made state robes, and none of his customers were in a position to order anything of the kind. Perhaps he would not have been capable of carrying out such an order had it been given him, but he may have cherished the thought as a daydream. What is actually at the bottom of this? When a man is asleep, he, with his ego and astral body, is outside his physical and etheric bodies, and he then finds himself in that being which has passed through repeated earth lives. That which strengthens a man inwardly, and which is inwardly active whilst he sleeps, is the ego and astral body. The experiences contained in these need not be limited to this present earth life. They may also refer to former lives. The above-mentioned case does not refer to anything hypothetical. On the contrary, it is something which absolutely comes from that realm of reality of which I speak. It may quite well be that the man in question, in a former earth life, had something to do with the ordering of a particular toga of state. He need not then have been a tailor. He may have been in the service of a Roman statesman, or even perhaps a friend of his. Having had such a strong and living wish to serve his master in the best way possible, his destiny may have created his present calling. In the collective life of humanity, wishes and thoughts are of the greatest possible importance. The memory of what the soul and spirit of a man thus experienced in a former earth life may flow through his astral body and ego. And in the morning, when he plunges down with his ego and astral bodies into the etheric and physical bodies, then, as I outlined roughly yesterday, the soul, which is still involved in the experience, the remembered experience, dips down into those ideas which the tailor may have retained in the etheric body in his present earth life. What he experienced in his old Roman life has been dammed up. It tried to enter the concepts and ideas which he has during the day. During the day, he only thinks of making clothes for the citizens of his small provincial town. Now, when the soul plunges down in the manner described, it finds extreme difficulty in transmuting the feelings it had concerning the beautiful state robe into the thoughts connected with the horrible clothes the tailor has to make. In the transition, in passing over from the toga to the ministerial robes of state of the present time, it undergoes a change. And only later, when it has altogether descended into his etheric and physical bodies, does the idea of what the man is now obliged to think about destroy what he experienced shortly before awaking. Thus, between falling asleep and waking, we live a collective human life, which in our inner being we set in opposition to the thoughts and ideas resulting from our earthly experiences. And this creates the peculiar configuration of our dreams. That is why it is so extremely difficult to distinguish between what first presents itself as the content of a dream, and which may be nothing but a confused hocus-pocus, and the true reality which really always lies behind that. The true reality of the dream may be quite different. We can, however, gradually accustom ourselves to find our way about in the confused occurrences of dream life, if we are alive to the fact that we must not pay too much attention to pictures conjured up before our souls in dreams, remembering that these pictures are really composed by the etheric body left behind in bed, which holds our thoughts and ideas. We do not have these ideas in our real inner being during sleep. We must distinguish this content of ideas from something else which I should like to call the dramatic course of the dream. We must gradually accustom ourselves to pay attention to this, and to ask ourselves, is this dream running along lines which, if the events recorded were to take place in waking day life, would give us great pleasure? Did we really experience this pleasure and satisfaction in the dream? Or were we heading straight for a catastrophe? Did we begin by first seeing certain things, which then disentangled themselves and led to a headlong fall or to a catastrophe? This is a question to be observed first of all in considering the life of our dreams. We must first consider the dramatic occurrences, not the thought content. A man may dream he climbed a mountain, and the path became steeper and steeper, and more difficult, until at last he reached a point where he could get no further, where he met with insurmountable obstacles. He feels that these obstacles must be significant of something in his life. A man may dream that, and the dream might be further investigated. Now, either he or someone else may have another dream, in which he goes into a cave which may perhaps lead into the depths of the mountain. At first, on entering the cave, there is still a little light, but as he goes on it grows darker and darker until he finally comes to a place which not only is in complete darkness, but where it is terribly cold, and so on, so that he can penetrate no further into this mountain cavern. Here, as you see, are two completely different dreams, both dramatically present an adventure which is at first quite easy. Then come difficulties and finally insurmountable obstacles. The pictures are quite different, but the dramatic course of events is similar. Now both of these dreams may represent the same event in the supersensible world, going on, as it were, behind the scenes of life. precisely the same thing may have gone on in the soul in both dreams. The very same thing may express itself outwardly in absolutely different pictures. This is mentioned to call attention to the fact that we should not, as is so frequently done, draw conclusions from the contents of a dream, but should first consider the dramatic course of the events depicted therein, and learn from that what the man's soul and spirit may have gone through. If this be done, and if we also strengthen the powers of imagination by such exercises as I have mentioned in these lectures, we shall gradually be able to get beyond the illusory picture world of dreams, and by grasping their dramatic purport, arrive at what is really the supersensible reality underlying the dream. Before speaking, as I shall have to do in the next few days, about the detail of dreams and its relation to the physical body of man, as well as to his spiritual nature, I should like today to give a description of the way in which man, through the world of dreams, is seen to have his place in the whole cosmos, in the whole universe. Indeed, we can see how there is quite a different connection between the different events of life in our dreams from what we experience in our waking life. There, as we have just seen by the examples quoted, the antitheses amongst which we are placed in the physical world always bear some relation to things. One thing follows as the result of what went before. The dream shows possible occurrences in the ordinary sense world, but in a complete state of disintegration. Everything is different, everything is disorganized. A being such as man himself, who, as a physical being, is attached by gravity to the surface of the earth, can suddenly fly. He can make skillful flights without any sort of flying machine. A difficult mathematical problem with which we have vainly wrestled becomes childishly easy, mere child's play. On waking, we may perhaps have forgotten the solution. That is our misfortune. But at any rate, we realize that the impediments, the difficulties we experienced in this respect in our day life, do not exist there. In the same way, everything which has solid cohesion in daily life is, in a sense, dissolved there. If we wish to make a physical picture of what actually takes place in dreams, or seems to take place, we may do so in the following way. Take a glass filled with water or other fluid, and put into it some kind of salt capable of solution, and watch the process. Suppose the salt had crystallized and taken definite form, so that when we put it in the water we see certain shapes. We then see these forms dissolving in the water, and assuming all kinds of fantastic shapes until finally, once more, we see a more or less homogeneous fluid. The way we form ideas in our soul's dream experience is something like that. Both the dream we have on falling asleep, as well as that just before waking, take the experiences of the past day, dissolve them, and give them all sorts of fantastic forms and all sorts of strange meanings, or what we should call strange and fantastic in our ordinary consciousness. A good image of this is to dissolve any kind of salt into a fluid. That is like what takes place physically and spiritually in dreams. Now, if a man is firmly rooted in the present world of ideas, it is not easy for him to grasp this fact in an unprejudiced way. For modern humanity, and especially those who call themselves scientific, know extremely little of certain things. I am not really saying this from any wish to discredit the evidence of science. I have no such intention. I set great store on the scientific mind, and should not like to see mere amateurs taking the place of earnest scientific experts. From the standpoint of spiritual science, we must always recognize the great progress made, as also the strict adherence to truth and accuracy of modern science. I wish to emphasize this strongly. Yet, the following has to be said. When people want to acquire knowledge today, they investigate earthly things and earthly processes. They study these and, by means of their observations, explore the laws of nature. Certainly they also make experiments for solving the secrets of nature and allow the results of these experiments to reveal nature's laws. In this way, a certain order of laws has been revealed, which is known as science. They gaze into the heavenly spaces and observe, let us say, the wonderful spiral nebula, and in these they see the separate centers forming, and so on. These things are proved today by means of photography, which shows them with even greater accuracy than can be gained with the ordinary telescope or such like. What do these students do next to gain knowledge of what is going on in space in those heavenly distances? They take the laws of nature pertaining to Earth, those laws they derived from the Earth by means of the experiments made, and speculate further as to how, through these same laws, a spiral nebula can have formed in distant space. They make hypotheses and theories as to the origins and ends of worlds, taking the discoveries made in their laboratories concerning the manganese, oxygen, and hydrogen of Earth as nature laws, and applying these to the heavenly spheres. If in so doing they discover new substances, they sometimes unconsciously point to the fact that they are thus entering a sphere with which science is not quite in accord. Hydrogenic gas has been found in distant space, as well as helium. But yet another element has been discovered, to which a curious name has been given, curious because it points to the confusion of thought connected with this. It is called nobelium. Thought here becomes nebulous, hence nobelium is put side by side with helium and hydrogen. If a man simply makes use of the laws of nature, revealed in his laboratory, to speculate after the fashion of the Swedish thinker Arrhenius, who has done a great deal of harm in this respect, as to what may be going on in distant space, he must necessarily add error to error, unless he is able to observe the following in an unprejudiced way. Here I should like to begin by giving you an example. You will know from your study of natural science that the English physicist and natural philosopher Newton established the theory of gravitation, of how the law of gravity rules throughout space. He conceived that the laws of the falling stone being attracted to Earth also extends to the mutual relation of all the heavenly bodies. He expressed the opinion that the greater the distance, the more this force of gravitation diminishes. For any physicists present here, we may state the law as follows. The gravity decreases with the square of distance, so that in twice the distance it is twice four times, and in thrice the distance nine times weaker, which signifies that the gravity lessens in proportion to the square of the distance. Well, now, such a law would be quite correct for such a force, but it is not possible, if we stop at purely physical existence, to conceive of this law in a sufficiently universal sense. The idea is that here is a cosmic body, its force of gravity lessening with distance. Here it is strong, and then it gradually becomes weaker. It is the same with the expansion of light. The light coming from a given source must always grow weaker and weaker. Man today can perceive this by means of his science. What he does not see is that while he, in his laboratory, applies the laws of nature to the earth and carries them out in his ideas, the truth and content of these laws grows less and less the further he carries them away from the earth. When, therefore, laws are recognized on earth for the combination of any particular elements, hydrogen and oxygen or any others, when the law of gravitation is established for the earth, the truth contained in such a law diminishes in proportion to its distance in cosmic space. If I establish a certain law of nature in my laboratory and apply this to a spiral nebula in distant cosmic space, I am doing just the same thing as though I believed that if I lit a candle here and were able to look out through cosmic space into the spiral nebula, I should see the candlelight as clearly there as here. It is just the same mistake to believe that what I prove in my laboratory here can hold good in distant space. Thus it is a really huge error to believe that what are discovered in the earthly laboratories as true laws of nature can be applied to the distances of heavenly space. Now, however, man is not shut out from subjection to that law under which he comes when the earthly laws, such as the force of gravitation and of light, no longer hold good. If we wish to discover in space a different order of laws from those of our own laws of nature, we shall have to go farther and farther away from the earth. If we wish to discover these in a more inward human way, we must pass from waking to sleep. Whilst we are awake, we are in the realm of these laws of nature. Everything we do is done in accordance with these. If we resolve to raise a hand or arm, the chemical-physical processes that take place in the bony skeleton correspond to the laws which we can investigate on earth, in our laboratories, or by observation. What dwells within us as soul passes out of the physical and etheric bodies in sleep. In so doing, it penetrates a world not subject to the laws of nature. That is why dreams so completely mock the laws of nature. We make our way into an utterly different world, one in which we are just as much alive while asleep as we are in the physical world when awake and in our physical body. This world is different. It has not our laws of nature. It has different laws. Every night when we go forth from our physical and etheric bodies, we plunge into a world to which our laws no longer apply. The dream is a power which sets up intense opposition to the laws of nature. When I dream, my dream shows me that I am living in a world which protests against the laws of nature and refuses to be subject to them. When I go to sleep at night and move out of my physical and etheric bodies, I am still half living in the laws of nature, but I am entering a world which is not ruled by them. Thus there comes about the intermingling of nature laws and supersensible laws in the dream. The same thing takes place when one is just waking up. It may be said that every time we go to sleep, we plunge into a world in which our laws of nature no longer prevail. And every time we wake, we emerge from that world into this one, in which they do. To picture this process aright, let us suppose the world of dreams is a sea in which we dwell, and we wake out of the flowing dream life in early morning. It is as though we made our way out of the flowing dream life. We move over from a supersensible system of laws into the intellectual laws of the sense world. It seems as though all that we see in clear outlines when we wake up is born from the fluidic and fluctuating. It is as though we see a window here, having first dreamt of it. The window would then seem to be born from something in the past, something indefinite perhaps, in which are various flames of fire from which it emerges. And if we dream very clearly, we should see how the very distinct outlines of the ordered day world of our consciousness emerge from these indefinite-like waves rising above the sea, and these waves form our day world. This is one of the points at which, when, as modern man, one investigates these things anew, one is overcome by reverent wonder for the dreamlike imaginations of earlier humanity, of which I have spoken in these last 2 days. I said, when we turn to the dreamlike imaginations experienced in the souls of an earlier humanity in their waking day life, which then took form in the myths and legends and the sagas of the gods, and which, compared to what we now grasp in our clearer conception of nature, flowed by in indefinite outlines. When we turn back to that, which can now be rediscovered quite independently concerning those old dreamlike imaginations, we acquire a reverent wonder and admiration for what lived in the souls of those men of an earlier age. From ancient Greece, a word still sounds forth, which, when once again we search for the truth in this domain, bears witness of the truth. a word sounds forth from the ancient Greeks, showing they still knew something of these things, and had the following idea. There is something which underlies the whole formation of the world, from which all definite forms arose, but which can only be reached when we leave the sense world in sleep, when we are in a dreamlike state. This the Greeks called chaos. All speculation and investigation into what this really is was in vain, for chaos is something which can only be approached by the man of today in his dreams. Only down to the Middle Ages was there still some sort of knowledge of that which, as something supersensible, underlies all external substances, the outer substance of all substances, which can hardly be called a substance. This, in the Middle Ages, was referred to as the quintessence, the fifth essence beyond the four other elements, earth, water, air, fire, the quintessence. Again, something penetrated the vision of the Middle Ages, when the poet, in so intuitive a fashion, said, "The world was woven from dreams." The Greeks would have said, "The world is woven from that which thou experienced when free from thy body. Thou canst get beyond the physical. The world is woven of what thou experiencest there as chaos." Thus, if we wish to understand what the Greeks meant by chaos, we must turn to what is not to be found in the physical, but in the supersensible worlds. Now, if we follow the whole process of going to sleep, dreaming, sleeping, and waking up, from the point of view gained by following the path to higher knowledge described in these lectures, through imagination, inspiration, and intuition, and rise by this means into the supersensible worlds, if we follow the dreaming, sleeping, and waking life from this point of view, we come to the following conclusion. Man passes in sleep out of his ordinary day condition into his life of sleep, in which the dreams may arise in indefinite chaotic form, but also in a more admirable, inward, and more coherent way. The physical body is left behind in bed, as also the etheric body, which, as the actual life-giving, formative, growth-stimulating principle, permeates the former. A duality is left behind in bed. A duality also emerges and penetrates into that supersensible existence lived between going to sleep and awakening, which I have described today from the point of view of dream experiences. This duality reveals itself to the higher knowledge of imagination, inspiration, and intuition in the following way. What really belongs to man when he emerges from his physical body and etheric body is his astral body. Do not let us take offense at mere words. As I have already said, we must have words, and another word could also be used for the astral body. I am about to characterize something of what concerns the physical body. I shall go further into this subject in the subsequent lectures, and we shall see that names do not signify. The important thing is the ideas which we are able to acquire. This astral body is composed of a number of happenings. Something happens to a man, something from his physical and etheric bodies. This occurrence, these proceedings, represent the astral body. We leave our thoughts and ideas behind in the etheric body. But in the astral body is spiritualized light, permeated with the cosmic warmth coming from the power of the love capacity. All this is to be found in the astral body. What is thus present in the astral body can plunge down into the etheric body at the moment of waking. It there gets dammed up and appears as the fabric, the play of a dream. It can also move out again from the physical and etheric bodies, and, forsaking the world of ideas, reappear as the fabric or play of a single dream. It is chiefly the astral body that carries us out of the physical and etheric bodies. This astral body is that being within us which, as I have already said, creates an actual opposition to the laws of nature. From morning to night, from waking to falling asleep, we are involved in the machinery of the laws of nature, which in respect to their part in space and time can be grasped by means of mathematics. When we go to sleep, we press out beyond the fabric of these laws, as also beyond the laws of mathematics. We eliminate mathematics, because our astral body does not contain the dead, abstract mathematics of three-dimensional space. It contains living, spiritually living mathematics, which only apply to a single dimension. I shall have more to say about dimension. It is this astral body which sets us free from our adherence to the laws of nature prevailing between our waking and sleeping. Through our astral body, we are moved into a very different world, the supersensible world. If we wish to represent this diagrammatically, we must say as follows. We move in the realm of the laws of nature while we are awake. But on going to sleep, we set out with our astral body, which was with us in our physical body. In the physical and etheric bodies, our astral body is entirely subject to the laws of nature. In all its movements and actions, it is so thoroughly within these bodies that it lives in the laws of nature. When the astral body leaves the physical and etheric bodies, it dwells in the supersensible worlds and is then subject to a different system of laws. It forms part of these. The astral body becomes quite different. In a sense, it puts on the straitjacket of the nature laws from waking to falling asleep. When it falls asleep, or in other words, makes its way out of the physical and etheric bodies, it moves about in the world of freer lawfulness, which is its own and to which it is adapted. It enters a world, it takes us as human beings into a world, which allows of free movement for the ego, for the real ego organism which now lives in the astral body, and with it left the physical and etheric bodies on going to sleep. The ego is now free in that world into which the astral body has carried it. Every night the ego is set free in a world where the laws of nature no longer hold sway, in which, free from the compulsion of those laws, it can do just what it likes. During our day life, these two principles form an undivided content in the innermost part of our souls. When, in the interval between sleeping and waking, our astral body is freed from the laws of nature, when we are in a world where neither gravitation nor energy nor any of those laws hold good, the road is then open for those moral impulses which, here below, only exist under the rule of the moral order of the world in which we live between waking and sleeping. In the time between falling asleep and waking, the ego lives in a world where moral laws attain the same force and power as the laws of nature here below. In that supersensible world, the ego is able to prepare something. In that world, in which, during the sleeping time, the ego is free from the laws of nature, it can prepare what it afterward carries out after going through the portals of death. Concerning the way leading from death to a new birth, we shall have more to say in the subsequent lectures. In picture form, in imaginations, which are, however, not brought forward, but exist as impulses of force, the ego can, in the time between going to sleep and waking, make ready the pictures of what it has to carry out in the real world of the spirit after passing through the portal of death, when the moral laws will prevail, as do our natural laws in the physical sense world. Between falling asleep and waking, the ego, set free by the astral body, is engaged in preparing the pictures of what it will have to accomplish between death and a new earth life in the reality of the spirit. So that we can say, the ego is already at work, though only in a germinal state, as a quite tiny spiritual germ, preparing what it will have to do in the spiritual universe after death. In this, which the ego is already working out in pictures during the hours of sleep, lies an indication of what we can carry over from this earth life into the next, not through any laws of nature, but through the moral impulse of the spiritual world. The causality of what we as moral beings have absorbed into ourselves as moral impulses can only be followed out because, in a sense, we place ourselves with a certain psychic obedience under their influence. Because the ego works at these during the hours of sleep and works further at them between death and rebirth, these moral impulses attain the same powers as the natural laws here. And they enter the human body, which we shall bear in our next earth life, as our temperament and character, which are wrongly ascribed to mere heredity, but which are already being worked upon during the sleeping time by the ego, when set free by the astral body, not into a world of nature, but into a purely spiritual world. Thus we can see how during sleep man even then prepares his future and makes ready for his next life. What then do dreams show us? They show us the work of the ego during sleep, but they show this in illusionary pictures. In the present earth life, we are not yet able to take in what is now already being woven for our next earth life during the hours of sleep. Dreams can also show us, as I explained at the beginning of this lecture, what we have gone through in former earth lives, and show this in distorted pictures. They may also show in chaotic form what is now being germinally prepared for man's future lives in times yet to come. The right interpretation of dreams leads us, therefore, to recognize that a dream is something like a window through which we must look in the right way, a window into the supersensible world. Behind it lies the fabric of the activity of the ego, which endures from former earth lives to those yet to come. If we interpret dreams in the right way, we are, in a sense, looking through the dream window of the world of the perishable in which we as earthmen are living, into a permanent world, into eternity, to which we with our real inner human being belong. I shall speak further of this tomorrow, the end of Lecture 4.